You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring international expertise from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm your host, Chaney Kouroniotis, and I run the communications department here at FSI. Today's episode continues our series on civil wars. We're highlighting essays from 8 FSI scholars in the latest issue of Daedalus, the Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Civil wars have changed a great deal in the post-World War II period. They last longer, they spill over borders, and in many cases they threaten security around the world. To help us shed some light on how and why this is happening, we're speaking with Jim Furon. He is the Theodore and Francis Jabal Professor at Stanford School of Humanities and Sciences and a senior fellow here at FSI. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
So please start by just telling us a bit about how civil wars have changed and why they are different from the general public's common conception of a contained and perhaps not protracted conflict.
Okay. Well, first, I'll say a little bit about how they've changed. One of the misconceptions or a common view, which isn't really right, is that there was not very much civil war during the Cold War, and then the Cold War ended, and then all of a sudden there's lots of ethnic conflict and civil war has broken out. Actually, if you look at it, the trend line, it's actually increasing from very little right after World War II and then steadily and pretty rapidly throughout the Cold War. But for interesting reasons, it wasn't really seen in a way as an international problem during the Cold War. Then the Cold War ends, and associated with the collapse of the Soviet Union in part, there is a big spike up in the early 90s. But actually, since the early 90s, there's been a quite considerable decrease in the amount of civil war going on around the world, although the levels overall are still quite high, maybe 1 in 6 non-microstates roughly these days have some, you know, pretty significant civil conflict going on. And the decline's been was going on really around the in all the regions around the world. The big change has been in one region, which is Middle East, North Africa, where since the early 2000s, that's the one region where we've seen quite a substantial spread and increase in the amount of civil conflict.
And one of the things you note in your piece is not so much that the number of new civil wars is increasing, but rather that the wars that are happening are longer in duration. Am I characterizing that correctly?
That's been true pretty much throughout the whole post-World War II period, is that a good part of the reason for that buildup from very few right after World War II to numbers between 25 and 35 these days ongoing, a lot of those ongoing conflicts are conflicts that have been going on for many, many years. And a lot of the buildup is due to the fact that the rate at which conflicts have broken out over the last 67 years has consistently been a little bit higher than the rate at which they have ended. So it's kind of like putting water in a tank. If you put in kind of random amounts in the morning and take out random amounts in the afternoon, and the random amounts you put in are on average bigger than the amounts you take out, gradually the tank's going to fill up. And so that's kind of what we see with civil wars, is we have more and more places, whether it's Philippines, Sudan, Afghanistan, Colombia, perhaps until recently, where you just had conflicts that were just hanging around for a really long time. And this pushes the average and median duration up globally quite a lot.
And what do you think are some of the factors that are causing them to last so long?
So the big picture here is that, the international system changed radically after World War II, or has changed radically, where you go from, the world politics was organized largely by colonial empires before the war. We have decolonization, which introduces an international system which goes from, 55, 60 independent countries right after the war to 193, I guess, in the UN today. Many of them really tiny, and a lot of them small, most of them quite small, post-colonial states that didn't have much of a state apparatus built during the colonial period, maybe a port, some roads, some cash crops, some things to enable natural resource extraction, but not much of a social, political, institutional infrastructure. So you have a change in the system where you have lots of states that are pretty shaky to begin with, and then when kind of subjected to various kinds of shocks, can become attractive for a group for various reasons to want to take over the central state or take over a region. And that kind of gradually and randomly happens. And then once you get them, once you get a group over the kind of military threshold, the states are quite weak in terms of their military capabilities, hard to end the war.
So what you're saying is essentially we have a lot of nation states now who never really had an internally created strong state in the way we would think about it. They simply went from externally imposed colonial power to a system that they were not internally prepared to manage without that external structure.
Basically, I think that's right. I think, you know, we're seeing with recent developments in some of the more advanced industrial countries that, you know, having a coherent and functional and capable government is not an easy thing to keep either. But yeah, the kind of standard, you know, real big picture story would be that European states over a period of several hundred years developed stronger institutional capabilities by virtue of fighting each other a lot, in part, or having to defend each other against possible invasion from another big power, and that this has not been the case in the post-colonial states, and that's related to their not having as strong, maybe a strong sense of national identities or sense of nationalism, which, you know, really in Europe is closely related to international competition and state efforts to promote national identities in the 19th century and so on.
So you also write that essentially the international system's response to civil wars was very different during and then after the Cold War, that essentially the way in which the international order approached the treatment of civil wars, let's say, was different. Can you talk about the evolution of that, how the international system has responded over the years?
Yes. So one of the really dramatic changes that you see is in the last, you know, 30 years is United Nations peacekeeping operations and other peacekeeping operations associated with regional organizations like the African Union or the European Union, for example. We really saw very little third-party intervention in civil wars during the Cold War, and certainly and very little organized through the medium of the UN Security Council. And that was related very directly to the Cold War, in that the U.S. and the Soviets would veto each other's preferences and initiatives, and both sides were, in some places, you know, funding their preferred rebel group against the government, or the government against the other side's preferred rebel group. So when that ends, the kind of the Security Council unfreezes and gets into the peacekeeping business big time.
So essentially, it's not so much that great powers were absent from these conflicts, but that the UN as an international peacekeeping structure was not actively engaged in mediating or ameliorating these conflicts.
Yes, that's right. And at the very beginning, you asked me about, you know, what are misconceptions about how civil wars are often thought about. And one of them is that they're these self-contained things without third-party intervention. I'm often asked, you know, something, well, is the conflict in Afghanistan or Syria or wherever a civil war, really a civil war, given that, you know, Iran or Russia or the U.S. or India or Pakistan is really driving it? And I'd say yes, because, you know, I'm not sure there's ever been a time when it wasn't the case that most civil wars had some significant third-party intervention.
So let's talk about how that international intervention changed in the time after the Cold War and the sort of international treatment activities that the UN and the African Union and other international bodies started applying to these regions to see if anything could assist in the end of these conflicts.
So yeah, so we see this big increase in UN and other international organization peacekeeping operations, that basically the basic idea is help facilitate a formal peace agreement, even if it's not a very flimsy one, and then facilitate its implementation by sending peacekeepers, facilitating elections, new elections, monitoring demobilization and disarmament and so on. And this becomes, you see this big increase in these kind of operations, mainly in sub-Saharan Africa, but there are, you know, important operations take place in Central America, and a few in Asia, and while there are some really high-profile and disastrous failures, or things that are certainly perceived, often with good reason, as big failures, Somalia, Rwanda, Srebrenica, and Bosnia, and so on, there are less well-known success stories. You know, maybe not wholly unambiguous and perfect successes, but nonetheless, places like Liberia or Sierra Leone or Eastern Slavonia, an operation that occurred in the Yugoslav wars, East Timor to some extent. You know, I could go on. Other operations, several in Central America, basically were probably quite helpful. And, you know, there's reasonably good research suggesting that peacekeeping operations can and do have a kind of causal effect on increasing peace duration after a civil war.
And would you draw a distinction between peacekeeping activities and state-building activities carried out by the UN and other organizations?
This problem of intervening to try to bring to an end and facilitate a transition to peace in the wake of civil wars pretty much immediately raised for the third-party interveners this question of, well, how can we actually leave unless, in a place where the state was weak to begin with, and or was largely destroyed by the fighting itself, if we leave without there being kind of a functioning, capable state, the civil war will just return. And, you know, to give an example, you see this acutely in the U.S.'s dilemma in Afghanistan, for example, or what's happening right now in eastern Syria, where, you know, having kind of successfully destroyed, achieved the military objective of destroying pretty much ISIS in these areas, the Trump administration is faced with the usual problem, which is like, well, if we just leave, what will stop ISIS from regenerating or other organizations? There's more to it than that with Iran and the Assad and so on involved, but that is a core issue for why in a recent speech here at Stanford, Secretary of State Tillerson at least announced verbally that there are, intention to kind of tough it out there because we can't let ISIS come back. So this is this fundamental problem which the international community, let's say, really hasn't squared, which is how do you build a state that can survive after a civil war? And it's not something that's been answered, unfortunately.
So we've come to our more contemporary issues of the civil wars that surround us right now and that are having, in many cases, an outsized impact both on their region and on the international security community at large. And of course, we often turn to the Middle East and North Africa as the place where some of the most difficult and intractable conflicts are located. What makes that region different from others in which international treatment or international activities have been successful? Why is it different there? Why is it harder?
I think there's a couple reasons. One of the most, the one I'd start with is that the degree of regional power competition and major power competition in Middle East and North Africa is significantly greater than it was in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, or in Latin America, Central America after the end of the Cold War. So this is a region where you've got a bunch of kind of regional power contenders with some sharp conflicts, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Turkey, Egypt. To have a peace agreement and third-party peacekeeping, you have to have major powers, third parties that basically agree on who they'd like to, or, you know, or are okay with an electoral process, or have some level of agreement on what the post-conflict government is going to look like. We don't have that so much in this region, and that is just a first-order bar to the kind of standard peacekeeping regime treatment that we saw in the 90s and 2000s in a number of places. A second big factor I'd mention is, in a way, nationalism in the region in the form of Islamist jihadi organizations who have as their objective, or one of their central objectives, expelling foreign influence. And so, if you brought in you know, Swedish peacekeepers something like that into Libya, you know, this would be a very attractive target for various jihadi organizations. Could you bring in Muslim peacekeepers? Well, then you get into problems of, well, would they be Sunni or Shia? And, you know, who would they be closer to in terms of these regional conflicts? So you have this problem of the costs to third-party peacekeepers. They're going to be attacked in ways that was not so much an issue in many of the operations in the 90s in sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America, for example. And you have this problem of regional and major power conflict over, you know, conflicting preferences of who's going to rule next in Syria, for example.
Are there parallels that you see between some of the conflicts we have in the MENA region today and ones that had more successful resolutions in the past or in other regions where we might be able to apply some different ideas? Or does this simply seem to be an entirely new category of problem?
One of the things about this project that you know, has brought me here, that Carl Eikenberry and Steve Krasner organized, you know, after the volume came out, they organized a trip to the UN in New York, which was where we presented some of these papers and findings, and in an afternoon, in one case, met with a bunch of kind of the high-level staff, not the top level, but the next level staff, who are, you know, mainly people in their 20s and 30s who are really idealistic about the mission of the UN and trying to facilitate peacekeeping. And I'd say they one of the things that was interesting about that for me was how frustrated they were. They had kind of entered their careers within this institution in the frame of the expectations and ideas of the 90s and 2000s concerning UN peacekeeping and the role it could play. And I felt a lot of frustration about where things were now, where they really were questioned. It was really unclear whether that kind of role could continue productively in the kind of present environment. And I'm not sure how many would put it this way, but it did seem to me like we're seeing a return to something. It's not exactly the Cold War, but we're seeing something more like the Cold War, in that the Security Council, the degree of disagreement among the permanent five on the members, the veto-holding members of the Security Council, has increased. And that's, you know, it doesn't mean that there won't be internal conflicts, so civil wars that come along that the P5 might agree about, and you could see this kind of the productive application of UN peacekeeping operations and associated post-conflict aid happen. But more often, we're going to see this kind of paralysis, and the action really goes outside of the UN to diplomacy and military activity. And that's, I'd say, very much what we're seeing right now in this, you know, extremely complex situation in Syria, where you've got, you know, essentially a power vacuum, you know, an Assad regime that has more or less won, or for large parts of the country, but is still devastated and heavily, heavily dependent on Russian and Iranian support. And that's sucking in or creating a whole bunch of complex interstate conflicts that are, you know, because different regional powers and the U.S. and Russia disagree about what they'd like to see happen there, and how much they fear someone else having a big foothold in that country. So how do you deal with that? It's not so much going to be the 90s approach, but rather something maybe more like traditional creative diplomatic efforts is, I think, the best I can come up with.
You've moved on to the question I was going to follow up with essentially is, we know this is very much a work in progress, of course, and the news from a lot of these war-torn regions continues to get worse. From what you've seen so far, is there anything we can do to improve the prognosis for this? When you talk about creative diplomacy or actors outside of the UN, given the sort of stalemate situation that we have between a lot of the great powers today, What do you see helping to move the needle, even if it's just small steps?
Well, it's not a very creative diplomacy, humanitarian aid, where you can work out how it places where it can be delivered without making things worse, which is also not necessarily an easy thing to do in some places. I'd also say that while they're really obviously there are these very hard and devastating from a humanitarian perspective conflicts occurring in the heart of the middle, of the Arab Middle East and in Afghanistan and Libya, which have much bigger, arguably bigger global consequences due to refugee flows directly into Europe, which affects European politics and so on. Nonetheless, if you take a step back and look at the global picture more broadly, as I mentioned, the amount of civil war going on around the world has declined quite significantly since the early 1990s, even including the recent increases in Middle East, North Africa. And moreover, if you look more closely and say, what about the scale of the killing? The scale of the killing in these conflicts has actually declined even more. The civil wars that were occurring in the 1980s and late 70s and 80s were far more lethal than like the average civil war today. So it's the picture isn't entirely bad, and I think that should be stressed.
Well, and on that positive note, we're going to wrap up here this afternoon. We will be talking to Jim's fellow authors in the Daedalus Journal about how civil wars are threatening people and societies around the world and what we can do to end them. To learn more about civil wars, listen to our December episode, Terrorism, Refugees, and Pandemics. Carl Eikenberry and Steve Krasner, the leaders of the Academy's Civil Wars Project, talk to us about why they decided to start the project and how they hope to end violence in war-torn nations by pulling together research from FSI scholars, including Jim Fearon, one of our senior fellows. Jim, thanks so much for being here with us today.
Thank you very much, Jamie.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you like this episode, even if it cast a Civil War-shaped cloud over your day, please review us on iTunes. It helps other people find the show. And you can subscribe to this podcast to hear more events and expertise from the world of international studies.